This is Casey Currents. I'm Alex Smith.
And I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. 3 years ago, Kansas City police reopened one of the most vexing cold cases in local history. It was the 1970 murder of politician and civil rights leader Leon Jordan. The case was reopened after an investigation by Kansas City Star reporters Mike McGraw and Glenn Rice. McGraw told us what one of the original detectives told him about the 40-year-old case.
I can't remember a case with less information, more blind alleys, more possible motives, and more possible suspects than the Leon Jordan murder.
But in 2011, the case was finally closed. Police identified the murderer as James Doc Dearborn, a leader in a crime organization called the Black Mafia. It was a complicated story involving politicians and both white and black mobsters. Some people who still remember Leon Jordan were concerned that the circumstances of his death may have overshadowed his groundbreaking accomplishments in Kansas City. Former Mayor Pro Tem Alvin Brooks says the older generation remembers Leon Jordan and his legacy here. But younger people say,
yeah, I kind of remember Leon Jordan. Did he get killed? Something happened to kill somebody? Or wasn't he owning something? Oftentimes, we don't pass people on to each other, I think, the way we should.
But throughout the reopening and reclosing of the Jordan murder case, one man has been deep in an investigation of the story of Leon Jordan's life. Robert Farnsworth is a professor emeritus of English at UMKC. He recently finished a biography called Leon Mercer Jordan, the founder of Freedom, Inc., following in the footsteps of his father and grandfather. It's been published online through UMKC's Labudd Special Collections. Susan Wilson and I spoke to Farnsworth back in 2010 when the murder case was reopened, and he shared with us Jordan's story. We're going to re-air that interview today. Farnsworth moved to Kansas City in 1960 to teach at what was then the University of Kansas City, and he met Jordan soon after. In early 1961, Farnsworth and his wife were asked to hold a meeting at their home for a new chapter of the civil rights group CORE, the Congress of Racial Equality.
And most of us were white, except for the Jordans and the Blankenships, two prominent black couples whom I didn't know at that time. This field rep wanted us to get organized and wanted us to elect officers. And since most of us didn't know each other, there was a lot of fumbling around, and somebody suggested that I become chairman of the group. And I think it was primarily because the meeting was at my home. And I said I didn't think that was appropriate since I was relatively new in Kansas City and particularly didn't know the black community. And at that point, Leon rhetorically put his arm around me and said, I'll introduce you to the black community.
The civil rights years that followed were a wild ride. And though Farnsworth says he and Jordan were never personally very close, he credits Leon Jordan with inspiring an interest in what would become his academic specialty, African-American literature, which eventually, 50 years later, led Farnsworth back to research the story of Jordan's life.
He had grown up in a very comfortable house economically. His grandfather had come and was seen in the black community as a relatively wealthy man. He invested in real estate quickly. He was a barber. He had a good source of income. And he had a very large family who were often in the news.
Jordan's father died when Jordan was only 13 years old. Farnsworth says he thinks losing his father at a young age was traumatic. Jordan ended up switching schools a lot and joined the Army at the age of 15. It was 1919, just after the end of World War I. But he was kicked out soon after they discovered his age. Eventually, Leon Jordan graduated from Wilberforce College in Ohio. He worked as a teacher and social worker before finding a job as a police officer.
At that time, Tom Pendergast ran this town, including the police force. And Farnsworth says Pendergast supposedly interviewed every police candidate himself.
When Pendergast fell, the first thing that happened was that the police department came under the control of the governor to clean it up. And he appointed a new police chief from the FBI who brought in a whole different method of organization and investigation. And it was very righteous and very, very scientific and all that sort of thing.
Farnsworth says Jordan thrived under the new leadership, and he and his partner were often written up in local newspapers.
Tom Webster, who was head of the Urban League at that time, frequently wrote letters to the police chief suggesting that they ought, either Cliff Warren or Leon Jordan had shown their ability and ought to be given much more administrative responsibility for their achievements.
And a promotion soon arrived, but not in Kansas City, not even in the United States. In 1947, the president of the West African country of Liberia called on Jordan to modernize the police force there. Jordan took a leave of absence from the KCPD. It was a challenge both he and his wife embraced.
As head of the constabulary in Liberia, he had access to President Tubman. They had dinners together, that sort of thing. And he was, you know, in the top echelons of society. And he was in with all the diplomatic corps. The French ambassador had given him a medal.
Leon Jordan had learned to fly before he went to Liberia. He had his own plane there. And Orca Jordan set up modern fingerprint and photography labs for the police force. But Farnsworth says Jordan never intended to stay permanently.
He came back here to Kansas City to see what all this would mean in terms of his advancement in the police department. They did promote him to a lieutenancy, and it was the first black lieutenancy in the police department, but they assigned him to the Flora Street station, and he was doing the same thing that he had done before, and he was only in charge of black officers, very limited. And there was no way he was going to accept this. And so he resigned, and he went back to Liberia. But this created a midlife crisis, in a sense. What was he going to do with his life?
Jordan returned to Kansas City again in 1954. He eventually bought the Green Duck Tavern on Prospect and 26th Street and sort of apprenticed himself to some local Democratic political leaders.
The black vote was often bought, you know, or controlled by these kind of political leaders, and it was pretty notorious. And then he and Bruce Watkins decided it was time that the political problem of the black community was its control by white politicians. Not just political control, but through the political control, it also included a great deal of economic exploitation. So I think he and Bruce both decided that it was time for the black political leadership to be beholden only to the black community and not to white political bosses. So they developed a theme, throw the plantation bosses out.
Watkins and Jordan joined forces with Charles Moore, Fred Curls, and Howard Maupin to form Freedom Incorporated in 1960. Jordan became chair. And in the very next year, the fledgling political group helped elect Bruce Watkins and Earl Thomas as Kansas City's first African-American council members.
In 1964, Jordan and Harold Holliday Sr. became the first African-American state representatives from Kansas City. Later that year, Freedom Inc. took on its first major citywide referendum, a vote on public accommodations, which would end segregation in public facilities and businesses like restaurants, buses, and stores. Farnsworth says this vote was a test for freedom.
It's very interesting. The Public Accommodations Act this time had the support of much of the white leadership, both politically and in church and social situations. But when it came down to the vote, the only reason the ordinance passed was because the black community came out so overwhelmingly in support of it. The white vote was negative, total, and it was a significant tribute to the organization of the black vote. It gave freedom a kind of authenticity within the black community. There's always been something of a question when you establish a black political party, is this just another faction? What is a faction? Does it make a difference whether you have black or white leaders, you know, depending on how that works out? This was an election which Freedom worked very hard at. It was an election in which the community saw the advantages of what they won. They were public and demonstrable. It was not something that lined any one person's pockets. There was no economic advantage. It was not some sort of payoff in any other sense. It was something that I think gave pride to the community and gave a sense that, hey, we've got somebody speaking for us now. And I think in that sense, Freedom gained a sense of power and responsibility for, to represent the black community.
In his research for a biography of political leader Leon Jordan, Robert Farnsworth finds that Jordan was successful partly because he was able to link what Freedom Inc. was doing locally to the national civil rights movement.
He was, in some ways, pretty imaginative, and he knew how to make significant deals, not just in local scene, but he played a key role in the careers of Richard Bowling and of Tom Eagleton. And so, in a sense, his influence reached both to the state and the federal government for good reasons. And he used that, and in some ways, what he did in both of those instances was ultimately very important for the civil rights movement in general. These were important leaders. What I'm learning and am a little surprised by is the fact that he was the boss. I've come across more and more testimony from Bruce Watkins, part of it published in The Call after Leon's death, and part of it in affidavits in the police file, etc., that made it quite clear that Leon called the shots. He was the architect. I've often tried to figure out how Freedom worked, you know, what kind of organization did they have. I knew some of the people that were involved. I particularly knew Harold Holliday. And Harold Holliday is not a compliant man. I mean, he was a man of considerable independence and strength and very outspoken. He didn't hesitate to speak up and voice his opinion. And apparently Leon listened to many people and took ideas from different people. But in the end, it was Leon who controlled the money and the decisions. He was a political boss. And in some ways, I think that's sad. Because I don't think he left a political structure that was institutionalized enough, structured enough, to carry on his work after he left. And I don't think Freedom has ever been the same. Now, I don't think that's the only reason that Freedom has never been the same.
Farnsworth says it's clear that Jordan was worried about the future of the organization.
He was very concerned about being able to pass on authority in Freedom, and he developed young leadership, and he had faith in those. One or two instances, I'm not so sure he chose the right people, but in the last years of his life, he clearly was ready to pass on that leadership. He was growing old, and I think that was also part of the problem in his death. I think he was ready to retire, ready to hand on, and there are several evidence of that. He came into conflict with a whole new generation of young black leaders, the black nationalist movement that he questioned and criticized and came into conflict with and tried to relate to, but it was a very uncomfortable mix. You know, it's clear after a while, a new generation just likes to shoulder the older one out of the way, and that was beginning to happen in some instances.
To finish his biography, Professor Farnsworth had to tackle the murder, and one of the last documents he read was the 900-page police file on the case.
It's scary, some of the things that I've seen in that file. Scary in terms of the violence of the drug culture that was in the black community at that time, and which were, in a way, trying to infiltrate the political organizations as well. And Leon did have some personal relations with some of the people involved, and it's complicated to try to explain or even to understand.
There were some difficult aspects to the man so many admired. For one thing, he had an eye for beautiful women.
Orchid tried to control it, tried to limit him in some ways, and then seemed to grow kind of tolerant, as long as it didn't become too obvious and too public. They seemed still to continue to maintain a respect for each other and a concern for each other. Ironically enough, on the night of Leon's death, Orchid expected him to come home with some ice cream. And that was apparently a ritual that they carried out regularly. He often, at the end of work, would come home with ice cream that they shared.
Orchid Jordan would end up taking over her husband's seat in the Missouri State Assembly for the next 16 years. They had no children together, which Farnsworth says might be one of the reasons his contributions to Kansas City history have not been remembered the way they should be. UMKC Professor Emeritus Robert Farnsworth will be discussing his biography of Leon Mercer Jordan next Sunday afternoon at the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library. Check our website for more information. This story was first broadcast as part of a series in 2010.